This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, this is Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Here's novelist Russell Banks.
The territoriality of identity politics, which seems to me not just wrongheaded, but dangerous, and for various reasons. I mean, you have to ask, who does it serve? Follow the money, that sort of thing.
Who does it serve?
Well, hegemony of identity of any kind serves marketing principles, basically. It's niche marketing. There's an economic use for it. There's a political use for it. You can target those voters with one speech. You know exactly how to do it. You can target the other voters with another speech, and you can bring them into your party. So I think, yeah, political and economic, and I think that writers themselves are often misled by it and manipulated by it, by identity politics, and they end up serving it for sometimes not so great reasons, economic reasons of their own, after all, guarantees them an audience. You know what section of the bookstore you go in, you're gonna go into. But also, more often the case, innocent and fearful reasons.
That was Russell Banks. Today we continue our special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing. I thought as part of our series about identity, it would be interesting to have two Latina writers, one who is very well established and one who is brand new to publishing in America. These are Sandra Cisneros, whose most recent book is Caramelo. It was published by Knopf in hardcover and... who does the paperback?
Vintage.
And the new book by Naina Marie Martinez is Caramba, A Tale Told in Turns of the Card. Now, I think that both of you have worked in your work with the kitsch of culture. And, you know, there is a part of all of us that says we want to build our culture out of the things we saw on television when we were kids, out of the toys we played with in neighborhoods with other kids, and to build another culture, not based upon high culture and inaccessible things, but the things that were around us. To what extent is that true of your work?
Me first?
Sure.
Okay.
This is Sandra Cisneros.
You know, I think for the children of immigrants, and especially if you're living on borders of class, as I was, with a middle-class father and a working-class mother, that sometimes the country that haunts you, that imaginary homeland, as Rushdie would call it, is made up of all the kitsch. You know, because when you actually go back to Mexico, the real Mexico isn't anything like the calendars or the plastic tablecloths that remind you of your last trip there. You know, it's all part of a nostalgia. So you create this homeland that's made up of lots of pop culture because it's embedded in your childhood. And your childhood is practically, for me, that was a part of the homeland.
Anna Marie?
And for me, I think it has so much to do with setting. I would rather write about the types of products and the types of things that maybe these characters drug home from the flea market than what the weather's doing, you know, whether it's hot or cold. I think that tells us so much about them, because I think we live in a society where, for better or worse, we're defined in large part by the products we use, you know, the cars we drive, where we get our clothes. Do we wear new clothes? Do we wear vintage clothes?
And when you're putting them in the book, this book is organized according to the cards. What are their names?
The Loteria cards.
Yeah. And they determine the course of the story as you go along. It's a deck that's turned up, and it becomes a device for storytelling, just as in the real world they're devices for fortune-telling, I think. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I hate to burst your bubble, but they're just... Loteria is just a fancy form of bingo. But in terms of fate or destino, as we say in Spanish, I think the idea is that these cards are being drawn out of this hat by this divine but anonymous hand, and that's the way that the story is being told. But actually, one day I woke up and I realized that this was a novel with six main characters, and I needed some way to direct traffic. So in a sense, that was the reason why these were put in there. And once I had those, I said, well, why can't I have other things? Why can't I have a playlist of the jukebox, you know? Because I think music is another thing that really defines a place. And why can't I have maps? Why can't I have handwritten letters?
I know why, because now we're all jealous and we want a book that looks like yours. It has, has beautiful end papers and prints. And, you know, if you're like someone like me who collects all of this stuff, you look at this book and you think, wow, this book looks gorgeous. How come my book can't look like this?
Be careful what you ask for. You might get it.
Well, I think you're going to start this stampede. We're all going to want, you know, like if we're an Indian writer, we're going to want a kind of Bollywood-esque. I think the design of this book is fabulous. It's just a pretty book. It's gorgeous, and you know, you may have done it to to organize your characters, but Caramba's going to start a stampede now. People, writers begging their publisher to have more control over what a book looks like.
Now, both of these books are published in hardcover by Knopf, and each of them, you know, you're not going to be with either of these books for more than 5 seconds before you say Gatina. They are, you know, designed to speak to an ethnicity. Do you feel comfortable with that?
I do. I mean, that's what I am. I'm not ashamed of it. And to me, I don't feel it's limiting. I think that I love my culture and I love all the things about it, whether it's a kitschy plate or a retablo or the folk art objects. And that the fact that the books exemplify that kind of beauty makes me love the book even more.
My cover represents what's inside. If it was something different, I would feel like it was false advertisement.
It's not just the cover. I mean, you've got, I don't know how you got them to do it, but it's a gorgeous book. I mean, it's full of colors and it's got, you know, a real look. It's the kind of thing, I remember when Hopscotch came out, Julio Cortázar's book, and this was a book that you read in all sorts of different orders. He suggests different orders for reading the chapters, and it's going to influence. I said, wow, here's a book like that that's going to give me a kind of game-playing aspect to it. It seemed like central to the book was that there was a party going on in it.
Well, for me, I set it up like a game to a certain extent because the different sections are different portions of a game.
I was really impressed with how you did that, you know, to create a new form of storytelling. And you had lots of little stories inside your stories just by descriptions of the loteria cards and the little letters in there. That was lots of fun. And I felt like I had to do that too, you know, because it's almost as if the form of the novel didn't give us enough room for all the things we wanted to say.
No, it's like I call them artifacts simply because, honest to goodness, I made up everything in that book. So for me, these are made up lives, but in a way, they really exist for me. And these are artifacts to prove, hey, look, you tell me that Lulabel doesn't exist. Well, here's the classified ad she put in the newspaper. It's sort of like the paper trail.
It's fascinating because actually, I thought I was having you on as two Latina writers, but you know what I'm thinking? I'm having you on as two pack rats.
Oh, that's true. You found that out about us. He knows. He knows us, Nina. It's out.
It's real. No, because years ago, Sandra and I were talking about how these sentences seem to exist in order to be fabulous arrangements of objects and memories, that her syntax itself keeps opening up in order to contain more and more, that there you can't fit enough in seems to be the strategy of the sentences in Caramella. And it makes for, interestingly, a sense of inclusion, because as these sentences go on and they begin at one point of a character's history and move to another point, you feel like you're surrounded by the life in the same way that the character is surrounded by these mementos and objects. Do you have these objects around your house?
I have. Two of the characters in the book have a yard sale. So, of course, there's a list in there of everything they sell, and I think I have about 4 or 5 selections from the list.
And if you don't have the others, you wanted the others,
exactly,
right?
I want them. And I want that Cadillac. I want that 1963 convertible Cadillac, but only to drive on Sundays because it gets such horrible gas mileage.
Now, how did you start writing, Nina?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I'm a high school dropout with a college degree. I went to a lot of high schools, and it wasn't working out because every time you change, the curriculum is different. So I left high school, and I went back to community college when I was 20, 21, and, you know, everybody told me, oh, you're a really wonderful writer. But who was I to flatter myself into thinking, oh, I'm going to write a book? You know, I'm just a high school dropout. So I ended up at the University of California at Santa Cruz studying literature. And they told me that, hey, if you change your emphasis to creative writing, you can stay here a year more. And here I was raising a daughter alone. I had a 1,000-square-foot apartment with hardwood floors and a view of the ocean.
Who wants to give that up?
Exactly. So I had already done about 150, 200 pages of Caramba. And, you know, I had reached the point of no return. Yes, I'm writing a novel, you know. And it just went from there.
Did you know what it was? Did it start as short stories or doodles, or what was the...
It started as an assignment, write a scene. And in that scene, I had Natalie and Consuelo. I had a born-again Christian mariachi, his mother, who was, or maybe wasn't, a witch. And I had another fella named Cal McDaniel, who was 5'4", but a big 5'4", who owned a nightclub of the same name. And I thought, wow, these people are really interesting. And it just, I said, I have more to say about them.
I'm talking to Nina Marie Martinez, the author of Caramba, A Tale Told in Turns of the Card, and Sandra Cisneros, the author most recently of Caramelo. Now, Sandra, you were a teacher.
Yeah.
And so you had, in a certain sense, the experience of seeing how to encourage. Because my sense is that you were the great traveling teacher and that your first book, The House on Mango Street, was already a bestseller because the students were learning to write and to read from it.
Well, I wouldn't say that I was a great teacher. I think I was a teacher that made a lot of mistakes, and that's how you become great. You know, you'd have a lot of whipped cream pies in the face. And, you know, it's hard being a teacher because just like writing, unlike writing, your mistakes are public. Whereas when you're writing and you goof up, it's a draft. You throw it away. But you do have to make those mistakes, and I made them for a long time. I wasn't a great teacher. I was lucky in that I had some lucky moments with my students, and when they would write well, you know, if you write long enough and you keep at it, you have to be diligent about writing and understand that you're going to write a lot of junk before you get some good stuff. And I was diligent with my students, so eventually they were forced to write something good. I don't know if that was anything to do with my teaching. I just think I was disciplined.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Sandra Cisneros, author of Caramelo, now in paperback from Vintage, and Nina Marie Martinez, author of Caramba, A Tale Told in Turns of the Card. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with Sandra Cisneros and Nina Marie Martinez.
Now, I'm fascinated. I was just told before the interview that you are an Alamex.
My mother is of German descent. My father is a first-generation Mexican-American, hence the name Nina. And then I have Marie, which I sort of consider that neutral territory because it's almost Maria, and it prepares you for the Martinez.
Now, do you feel a German influence in your writing as well? Is the writing both?
Well, the German part goes way back, but my mother's parents, my grandparents, are from the Midwest, and I think I got something of a twang going on in this book. So I do feel that influence. And as I've told Sandra, you know, I feel like I'm Norteño music personified because the Germans came to the northern part of Mexico and they left the polka behind, and the Mexicans took it over. So I have both going on. I think it's a nice mix.
That's great. It hadn't occurred to me until I met Sandra. We were talking some years ago, and she explained to me that in her life, the lives of the saints played the role that was played in my life by Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty or other fairy tales. She said, oh, no, I had Maria Teresa. So I was curious, what kinds of stories influenced you?
What kinds of stories? You know, we were talking about influence yesterday, and I don't know that I was really influenced. I think the word I like to use is legitimization. When you read books like when I read The House on Mango Street, or even you read things and you go, I have stories like that in my family, and it makes you feel like, hey, I can write something too. Or even I remember reading Althusser in college and going, I've had these thoughts. Maybe I didn't put them down on paper and make them sound really poignant like he did. But when you read these great writers, it makes you feel like your own thoughts are legitimate. But as far as influences, you know, I really like Thomas Pynchon. I like Hemingway. And right now I'm reading Chuck Palahniuk. Am I saying that right? Just because I like his take on consumer culture, which is something I'm interested in, too.
That's fascinating.
Weird, huh?
No. In what way weird, by the way? Tell me what you mean.
Well, oh, it just seems like I just feel guilty to be reading. You know, right now I'm in the white male stage, you know, reading.
There's nothing to be ashamed about.
And I feel like, no, I should be reading something different. Lolita, I love the language of Lolita.
The thing is, you know, people don't realize that about us, that we read everything all over the world, whether it's Nabokov or Duras or Pavese. You know, the whole world is what we're reading.
This is what I want to talk about, really, I guess that was what I meant about the cover of the books, that in both cases, the publisher is narrowing a target for the book when the writing life comes from everywhere. You know, what I want to address in this series of shows is that idea that we might be saying, I'm a dropout with a college degree, but that's our own kind of commodification. And between that and the insistence that we create an image of ourselves that has to do with our ethnic identity and not with individual identity, when the essence of writing is discovering individuality and mystery in particular, whereas, you know, that identity thing seems to be about explaining things to people, I think that most writing is telling people, no, there is no solution. Grace in art is a mystery, and it's about a blind exploration rather than a willed one. Does that make sense, Sandra?
Yeah. I think sometimes when they tell us, or we feel, especially as writers of color, sometimes you feel a little bit guilty about what you're reading. You're supposed to read this or you're supposed to read that. But I think our hearts really have their own appetite for what we need, and that becomes our curriculum. You know, this is what we have to read. I always read as if I'm hungry or searching for some answer that I have to get to before my death. And, you know, it takes you to different fields and different areas and different genres and different times in your life.
Yes, indeed it does. I agree. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I do feel guilty when people say, so, who are your favorite writers? What are you reading? And I say, they're all white males. You know, sometimes it feels like we should be reading other women of color. And, of course, I have, you know, I do read women of color. But, yeah, it's good to get the chance to say, hey, you know, there's a whole broad spectrum out there that goes into the work. You know, I went back and I gave my professor a copy of this book, and he was a professor of cultural studies, and I said, you know, you're not going to see the influence of Marx in here and Althusser, but all of these things went into the making.
But I think you do. You see, yes, I mean, I know what you mean, that it's going to be easier for people to describe this book as a piñata, you know, filled with all kinds of things. But that's not what it is. It's a really seditious study of culture, and it's arranged through people who are victimized, in fact, by the disguises that they're being forced into. I mean, you know, that's what makes the book not only funny, but kind of beautifully sad, you know, because they end up playing out the destinies that their images have chosen, rather than destinies they themselves have chosen. And I think that was intentional on your part. Am I wrong?
Yeah, it was intentional. I mean, I think the tragedy and the comedy, you know, and just should be there. I'm hoping that they're there. And I have a character that's a born-again Christian mariachi. And what I say about him is he's a man, a mariachi, and a missionary. You know, and all of these things are at odds with one another. And by juxtaposing all of these different characteristics in one character, you get to hopefully maybe discover a little bit about each of these stereotypes, labels, whatever you want to call them.
I think a lot of your work, too, Sandra, is in answer to stereotyping, particularly in the poetry, where the need to say, don't expect me to be demure. I have an image of a wild woman, and it's not accurate. And I have an image as a daughter, a demure daughter, and it's not accurate either. Truth falls between images and creates its own new cracks, it seems to me.
Yeah. I think sometimes things that I write about also create a stereotype because people think I'm everything that I write about. I was just saying to Nina just before we got on, I think I'm going to have to be forced to write an autobiography because even when we tell the stories ourselves, we kind of exaggerate.
Oh, kind of, just a little bit.
Storytellers. We want the laugh or the good punchline. So, you know, you say something and then someone else picks it up and next thing you know, they've mythified you. So you feel like, where's the truth?
Do you try to counteract that?
Well, I feel as if I'm the culprit, that I take a lot of personas and people that I know and mix them up and make them into my characters or to my personas in poetry or fiction, so people feel that they know me. People come up to me at book fairs all the time. They really call me by my first name and feel that they know me. And I think that's good because they're convinced that everything I write about happened to me.
And I think that there's a lot of purgatory in my book. There's a lot of the neither here nor there. And that's where we're from. We're not from here. We're not from there. We're somebody in between. We're a third of the way or three quarters of the way. It's not cut and dry. It's somewhere in between, you know?
But tell me more about the in-between state.
Well, let's say you don't, you know, Consuelo doesn't speak English or Spanish to perfection, so she messes them both up, you know. I mean, I'm half and half. I come from two very distinct cultures. What does that make me? Somewhere in between, you know, leaning more towards this end as opposed to that end. You know, it happens all over the place, wouldn't you say?
You know what? After I wrote the book, I was sorry I didn't include this other homeland. I went to a mall that was closing, like a lot of businesses are closing in San Antonio, thanks to the economy. And it was a Western wear store, and everything was on sale, so I had to go in there. And the girl there, she knew who I was, and she was, you know, she went to community college. She was really happy, and she knew me. And she said, yeah, I'm like you. I'm Mexican. She didn't say Mexican. Or Mexican, she was Metzican.
And I love that. I wish I had had that voice and had taken that term, M-E-T-Z-K-I-N, Metzkin, for my text. And I thought, I got to do something with that. And last night when I was looking at this Guadalupe book that came out from Mexico on the Virgen de Guadalupe, there was a word in Nahuatl that is Metzkin, and it means ombligo de las nubes, navel of the clouds. So that's where she was from, the center of the universe, which is the clouds, which never need papers to cross the border.
Well, and also, I mean, there's a whole generation that I grew up with, you know, Mexican-American girls that didn't say pretty, they said purdy. Now, my 62-year-old Mexican-American father doesn't say pretty, he says purdy. And as a matter of fact, there's a girl in Caramba that doesn't want to go back to Mexico or Mexico. She wants to go back to Mexico.
That's right. That's it.
You know, and we eat sandwiches, you know. There are people that eat sandwiches, and there are people that eat sandwiches.
And then there are people in Texas who want chicken.
Chicken.
Yes. Uh-huh. They can say chichi castanego, but they can't say chicken. I don't know why.
Well, that's wonderful. But is this going to change the language?
Well, it has. And, you know, there's this whole, like, middle place. You know, to me, in la, that's a la frontera. And the frontera could be on the border, or it can be in your neighborhood over there in Santa Cruz, or it can be in Los Angeles, or in barrios in New York, or anywhere.
What I always say is this, and this is what really makes me so excited to be a writer. English and Spanish are live languages, hence they're always changing. You know, when either or both languages are set in stone like Latin, then we need to start worrying about it. But for now, let's just have fun and let's not be uptight if somebody says purdy instead of pretty or if somebody orders a sandwich.
Yes.
I've been speaking delightedly, thank you, with Naina Marie Martinez and Sandra Cisneros. Naina Marie's novel, Caramba, has been published by Knopf. Sandra Cisneros' masterwork, Caramela, has recently appeared in paperback from Vintage. I want to thank you both for coming and joining me.
Always so much fun to talk to you, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you. Indeed it was.
Thank you indeed.
This special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing, is produced by Michael Silverblatt, Melinda Siegel, and Alan Howard. The engineer is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.